I am the last person to will play in the minute. It's just that the funding required fairly substantial amount, and so you see, started with 9th plan. I gave a colloquium here after my postdoc. So Virendra Singh came and said, "Oh, fantastic colloquium," and so on and so forth. "And what you are planning to do?" Question was asked in the same hall. I said, "Build a dilution, pull the ultra low temperature refrigerator." So he wisely nodded his head and went away. So I talked to my boss Girish Chandra at that time. He said, "Why don't we put it as a 9th plan proposal?" The funding was a bit high. 50 lakhs on those days are quite substantial. So at the end of the plan, Professor Girish Chandra came and told me that no, it was not successful because of the money is large. So we didn't give up. So Girish Chandra retired around this time. So I became a PI. So I gave a lecture here as a part of the 10th plan. Jaji was sitting there, and so we went to the usual proposals and so on. Somehow the few of the reviewers who worked on low temperature physics felt that most of the physics probably done at this end, probably it's not wise to invest manpower and money on this. We didn't give up. So we just proposed it again on the 11th plan. Of course, the money is now even more larger, 120 lakhs. Professor Kurup was the dean at that time, and Professor Kurup supported me. He said that it is something unique in the country, and if you feel some good physics can come out of it, I will support. And then, of course, Shobo also supported heavily. Without these two, this money wouldn't have come to the lab. So it required a lot of work in the lab, shifting and so on. And then, of course, while this was going on, we had the fortunate, or my misfortunate, few of the Nobel laureates visited our laboratories and said that, "Oh no, no, putting in this hostile atmosphere, probably you may not reach below 1 mK. Because usually these microkelvin platforms are built in a separate building or in a separate lab. So you want to put it in CG35 with a pit, good luck," one of them said. So we went ahead and built this thing. And this was a tough period because I was happened to be a dean of that time. So, you know, working administration and this was a little bit of a task. I must say that my student, Dr. Naren and Chennabatti, worked really hard for this. So the fine tuning was done in 2011. The first result came out just in 2015, but we did extensive measurement, repeat it, and then published in 2017. So as I said, I'm not going to talk about dilution refrigerator. The first step is that is how to reach this low temperature. So you cooling with helium, you can get down to about 1.2 Kelvin. The vapor pressure is so low that you can't get anything below this. Then there is also a superfluidity. So you can't get much with helium-4. Helium-3, which is an isotope of helium-4, its boiling point is 3.2 Kelvin. You can get about 0.3 K. Again, the vapor pressure becomes so small that you can't go below that. The dilution refrigerator, I think this is the one which will be talked by Anil towards the end of the year. So you can get down, this is a commercial instrument, you can get down to about 5 millikelvin. So what I am going to talk about is the adiabatic nuclear demineralization, how to reach 40 microkelvin, how to measure, and then what is the physics one can do, an example of what kind of physics we can do at that temperature. So nuclear demineralization, measurement of temperature, and superconductivity of bismuth, this will be in brief. Because I gave a colloquium in September where I explained why the superconductivity of bismuth is very important. Okay, so this is the commercial dilution fridge, which has a large helium-3 dump and 176 liters and 600 liters of helium. How to reach low temperature, I think Anil will explain later. I am not going to talk about it. So the actual instrument dilution has several heat exchangers. The lowest temperature is provided at this point, which is known as the mixing chamber, to which we attach 5 kilograms of copper, gold plated 5 kilograms of copper, which is this, about 18 centimeter long. It is slitted, there are very fine slit running around, because this is the one we are going to magnetize and demagnetize. So to avoid the eddy current, there is a slitting on this. And so this took us some time to build, nearly 2 years. There is also interesting history, because I had the design of this along with the heat switch, which I am going to talk about, when I came back after my postdoc. So Giorgio Frassati from Leiden in cryogenics was interested in building a nuclear refrigerator. He had some few commercial offers, including ours. So we decided that we will build together this copper nuclear stage. Of course, the design is taken from my mentor Frank Pobel, for where I spent a couple of years. So we built that. And before I go to the adiabatic dematization, for the benefit of students, let me explain what do you mean by how do we reach low temperature using adiabatic dematization. What I have here is the magnetic refrigeration, and what I have here is the vapor cycle refrigeration. It's quite similar. What you do in vapor cycle refrigeration? You take a gas, pressurize it. Because of the pressure, the temperature goes up. So you have a suitable cooling bath, take away this delta T, that is, you remove this heat. So then the gas is again at that same temperature, but at a higher pressure. So you release the pressure, the gas expands, it takes the heat from the surrounding, so it cools. Similarly, the thing about paramagnetic refrigeration, you have paramagnetic spin, apply a magnetic field, they get aligned along the magnetic field direction. You have a heat of magnetization, remove this heat of magnetization, you have these parallel spins, and then when you remove this field, it tries to go back to its equilibrium state, which is the disordered state, highest entropy. So it takes away this heat from the surroundings, so you can get cooling. So what we do is that, of course, if the spin orders to a ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic state, we lose the cooling. But let us assume that they remain paramagnetic down to lower temperatures. We deal with nuclear moments, which is about 1,000th of the electronic moments. The ordering temperature is small. So you can reach very low temperatures using adiabatic demagnetization of nuclear spins. I must pause here and tell you, when this budget was 1.2 crores, there was a special committee. I think the present FA was also a member of that committee, if I remember right. So Kurup was sharing that, and Kurup told me, make your proposal attractive to DAE. So quickly I changed the adiabatic dematization to a nuclear refrigerator. It went sailing through. So I am truthful. Only thing is that I am twisting words. So it happened without any problem. In fact, it got cleared within 30 minutes for a 1.2 crore project. It's probably one of the records around here. So anyway, so what do you do in adiabatic dematization? What you plot here, the y-axis is the nuclear spin entropy, and what you see here is the low temperature. So you have this 5 kilograms of copper, you have a heat switch and connect it to this mixing chamber. So you cool this 5 kilograms of copper first to the mixing chamber temperature, which is 10 millik. Apply a magnetic field. So you are in this curve. Let's say Tesla, you are in this curve, entropy versus temperature. Then you make this switch, disconnect the millikelvin stage from the nuclear stage by a superconducting switch. I will tell you about this. So what do you do? So you do a slow demagnetization, that is, remove the magnetic field very, very slowly. You fall on this line and hit this curve. You stop the magnetization at 8 millitesla. You go to about 20-30 microkelvin. So this is how it is done. The heat of magnetization, which is this, it is taken away by this dilution fridge. Make the switch, which was normal, to a superconducting state. So it's a thermal cutoff between this and this. then you reach very low temperature. Well, in principle it is fine. Everything is crucial on this switch. So what do? We use superconductors. Superconductors are excellent electrical conductors, but a very bad thermal conductor. So what happens, what I plotted here is the, you see the thermal conductivity of copper, extremely pure. This is the thermal conductivity of aluminium. In the normal state, it is quite similar to copper, but at low temperature, the thermal conductivity drops by almost a million times. So if you have a very high pure copper, the thermal conductivity, the normal state to the thermal conductivity of superconducting days goes as delta D by T squared, where theta D is the Debye temperature. And Debye temperature of aluminium is good. You can have it in high pure state. Another thing is that the critical field is not very large. It's about 30 millitesla. So it is easy to switch aluminium to a normal state, to a superconducting state with a moderate magnetic field. So again, this design which I am going to show you, this was with me for some time. This was of course taken from Professor Pabel's design. So but then we collaborated with Prasati to make this switch, because he was also doing for the first time according with my design. So what we have is about 30 foils of aluminium and pressure welded together, and then it is welded to this gold plated copper on this vine, and which is threaded to this mixing chamber. One side it is threaded to the mixing chamber, the other side it is threaded to this nuclear stage. So what you see is a niobium cap, and inside is this solenoid which provides 30 millitesla field to make the aluminium switch normal or superconducting. So this took nearly about an year to finish it, because the thermal switch is very important and it has to be tested on a real working nuclear stage, and then we have to request some of our German friends to test this whether it really works or not. So this required a little bit of R&D, and finally it turned out that it has a switching ratio of something like 60,000. So it cuts off that much of a heat leak from the mixing chamber to the nuclear stage. Because we are putting magnetic field, we want to avoid the eddy currents. So otherwise it will heat. So avoid the eddy currents, we want it in this foil form. So now what is the choice of the refrigerant? Again, this was heavily borrowed from Pabel's lab. He had quite a success with the copper, basically because it's a good metal. It has a relatively small spin lattice relaxation time. See, this spin lattice relaxation time is what you are cooling here is the nuclear spins. Okay, so the nuclear spins ultimately has to cool the electrons and then the lattice. So if the nuclear spin interact the nuclear spin time, lattice relaxation time is very large, what you will achieve is cool the nuclear spins. You can't cool the lattice or the electrons. We want refrigeration, not to study only the nuclear spins. So the spin lattice relaxation time has to be short, at least in the laboratory scale. So copper is not bad. It has no electronic ordering, because again, as I told you earlier, if there is a magnetic ordering, then we lose the entropy, so we can't go to lower temperatures. So the nuclear ordering temperature and the internal field will be very low, and that is realized in copper. That is the reason why we use copper nuclear refrigerator. So the point here is that once they form a Cooper pair, you understand, they form a Cooper pair. See, the electrons bind together with an attractive interaction, form a Cooper pair. They don't take place, they take part in the thermal conduction.
From that point of view, you are talking, normally what happens,
That, see, that Weissman-Francois will work for the normal metals, not for the superconducting state. See, once the pair formation happens, it goes to a macroscopic quantum state, the Cooper pairs don't conduct the heat. So that's why traditionally now, even in the high TCs, people are using that for the case of leads, is basically because of that. Anyway, okay, so as I said, there are many advantages of copper: workhorse, non-superconducting, the nuclear ordering temperature is small, the internal field is small, and you can make this residual resistance ratio is the resistance at 300 Kelvin and the resistance measured at 4.2K. So that is the ratio. How pure is your sample is decided by this factor. So 4N, it's 99.99 electrolytic copper. Sorry, this is out of focus slightly. And what we do, how do we connect? The switch is connecting this to this stage, but we need a thermal, we need a mechanical support. For that, what we use is what is known as a Vespel. It's a polymer and it's a very good insulator at low temperature, both thermal and electrical insulator. Vespel is the name of this company, DuPont, which makes this. So as I said, it is not enough to produce this temperature, you need to have a mechanism to measure the temperature. So these are the landscape. I think you can't see this very clearly. This is 100 microkelvin to 100 Kelvin. So you have platinum resistors, these are resistors, there is a vapor pressure thermometer, the helium 3 melting curve thermometer, superconductors, fixed points, superconductors, transition temperature as well defined. You can use that as a fixed point to calibrate the secondary thermometers. Cerium magnesium nitrate, I think Anil will talk about this. So then there is gas thermometer. So what I am going to talk about is this noise thermometer, which is a commercial one available now from 1 mK to about 1 Kelvin. We actually, a couple of years ago, we extended this commercial magnetometer, noise thermometer, down to about 600 microkelvin. So, but we never got around to publishing those details. Now, I think in January, there is another paper from a group which originally made this sensor. They can show that they can measure down to about 40 microkelvin. They have a system 45 microkelvin to 4K. It's a beautiful thermometer, so I'm going to talk a little bit on that.
Just 1 minute. This low temperature at 80 microkelvin order, this superconductivity has been achieved in microkelvin order. What is the actual temperature order in Bose-Einstein condenser, where evaporative cooling, various other processes that utilize to achieve the very low temperature.
You are talking about laser cooling?
Laser cooling.
Yeah, they are two different beasts. Those guys are a little more cleverer than us. We are talking about, you know, brute force refrigeration, where the nucleus spins are cooled, nucleus spin cools the lattice. There, what they are doing, they are stopping the motion of the atoms, vibration motion of the atoms through lasers, and reducing the temperature. They can go to nano Kelvin or even better, pico Kelvin, easily. And you have the 300K photons lying all around, okay? But here it's not that. We are doing refrigeration. So they cannot do refrigeration. They can do individual atoms, do wonderful things they are doing, which we cannot do, okay? But if you want to study properties of materials at very low temperatures, refrigerate them, this is the only way. This is a brute force way compared to the very nice, elegant way of laser cooling. So what we do is to measure the noise thermometer. Somehow it got stuck. Wait. Okay. So this is a beautiful illustration of statistical mechanics. So what is shown by Johnson is called Johnson's noise, sometimes Nyquist's noise, depending on you are an experimentalist or theorist. Okay. So there is a voltage fluctuation because of the random motion of the electrons at a finite temperature. And since the random noise, the average voltage is zero, but you have a the mean square voltage, which is explained by Nyquist. This is 4, Kb is the Boltzmann constant, T is the temperature, R is the resistance, this is the bandwidth in which this noise voltage is observed. The only condition, of course, is H cross HF is very much less than KBT. So this voltage noise also leads to magnetic field noise. The thermal magnetic flux density at a SB at a distance Z from the surface of a large conducting plate has been calculated for D less than Z. It is given by this expression, where mu naught, KB, these are all fundamental constants, T is the temperature, Z is the known, D is the thickness, sigma is the conductivity, and FC is the cutoff, which is given by this expression. So if you measure the noise spectrum, that is by doing a fast Fourier transform of the noise measured, and that has this expression. So you see here, this is constant. The only variable here is, and in the noise thermometer, you make sigma as constant with respect to temperature. So you can do that by treating the metal in the condition that it has no temperature dependence of resistivity, and then you have only the temperature which is to be measured. So this is like a low pass filter. I mean, if you look at the power spectrum, its expression is A by B plus F by C squared. So what do we do? We use squid to pick up these voltages, because the voltages are going to be pretty small. So there is a commercial one exists. It costs about 12,000 euros. Earlier work to be 1 millikelvin to 4.2K. I have just written 4.2K as 4,200 millikelvin, just to tell you this, the range at which it is working. We actually did this down to 0.6 millikelvin at TFR. We will tell you why I said it is 0.6. We have another sensor to calibrate this. Initially, this we used to calibrate that one. At very low temperatures, we cross-check this with respect to platinum NMR, which I will come to. So this is actually the magnetic fluctuation thermometer. It's a thin film superconducting quantum interference device. I will briefly tell you what is squid, and it is all in a 3 millimeter by 3 millimeter chip pasted on this copper, which is again attached to this, whatever, either you can attach to a mixing chamber or you attach to the nuclear stage. In our case, it is attached to the nuclear stage. So the resistive magnetic noise coming from the resistor is picked up by this transformer, which is transformer coupled to this, what is known as the DC squid. So this works reliably down to 0.6 millikelvin. Only thing is that it has onboard electronics, which is here, and that is, so the signal is quite heavily massaged. The noise which is coming, there are two independent source pickups of the noise, which goes to two independent squid and two independent, this is the flux lock group electronics of the squid, the band pass filters amplified, then there is an anti-aliasing, then an AD converter, which gives you in terms of the voltage output. The two systems are used because we want to avoid the amplifier noise. So we do a cross correlation, that is, the noise of this amplifier is independent of the noise of this amplifier. So when you do a cross correlation, you can eliminate the noise due to the preamplifiers. So because of this massaging, this S5F is S naught, you know, instead of the power which is happening, this actual expression changes a bit. So this is not a basic major problem, because what you need is measure the power spectrum as a function of frequency, and you can, these are variables P1 and P2, sorry, the variable parameters which you fit P1, P2 by doing one measurement at 4.2K, because 4.2K is a fixed point. Liquid helium boiling point is 4.2K. So you can fix this, and the software does the rest. Then what is left is if in another temperature, you just simply measure the S5 and that is proportional to T. So C is known because you have done this measurement at 4.2K. So once you measure S5, you know T. The important thing is that it works pretty well. So what I am going to show is, this is the actual noise spectrum and that is the fitting. So this is something, the temperature is about 17 millikelvin or so. And so you can also measure this as a function of yours. So as I told you, when you magnetize the nuclear stage, there is heating. And initially the nuclear stage was as 10 millik when there is no magnetic field. The moment you put the magnetic field, it goes to 70 millik. It takes about, this run was done in 39 hours. It just comes to the about 17 millikelvin, and about 48 hours it comes to about 12 or 13 millik. So what we do, we magnetize it, run the dilution for 48 hours. God helps you if you have a power failure in between, so you start again. This is the range, temperature range Murphy laws likes very much. So these are some of the pain again. So noise thermometer is good down to 1 millikelvin. So we need to measure down to at least up to 10 microkelvin. So we do what is known as a platinum NMR. So what we measure is the nuclear susceptibility here. The susceptibility is defined as magnetization by nuclear magnetization by applied field, which is related to a Curie law, except that the theta n, the nuclear ordering temperature, is very much less than T, so we neglect that, it just goes as C by T. So what we do, we have an NMR coil, apply a field along the Z direction, and then apply a field along the RF field along the Y direction. Initially it presses, when there is no field, it presses around the B naught with this gyromagnetic ratio. When you apply a field along the Y direction and then leave it, this transverse component M xi, it is going on the XY plane, and that induces a voltage along the X axis. So this voltage, I think you can derive it as this, and taking the ratio of these two, which is ratio of the magnetization, it is T2 by T1. So if you measure it at one temperature, and then you know how to, you know, calibration is usually done at 10 millikelvin, then we extrapolate. So this was the situation when we came into the scene, in a sense that we were not very happy, because you are measuring 40 or 10 microkelvin, you are calibrating at 10 millik. So it's about 2 to 3 orders of magnitude in temperature you are going down. How do you expect such a linear extrapolation? You know, it's like you are measuring something at one temperature, you go 3 orders of magnitude down, expect that this linear relation should hold good. So this poses a serious accuracy in your measurements. Suppose if the noise thermometer would have been not with me, then my error in the temperature, let's say when I said 530 microkelvin, it could be anywhere between 700 microkelvin to 300 microkelvin. So I can't fix it that well when you are extrapolating from a very high temperature. So that is the reason why we made the noise thermometer to sit where the platinum thermometer is. Then I know I am not extrapolating too much. I can calibrate the NMR thermometer at 1 millikelvin and also check down to 0.6 millikelvin whether they are matching, and they were matching. So that is why I said the accuracy, 530 microkelvin, it's plus minus 5%. Otherwise it would have been plus minus much large on this system. So I think after we did this, and as I said, in the January 2017 Advances in Sciences, they have built a noise thermometer which goes down to about 50 microkelvin. So I think in future, probably the platinum thermometer could be just phased out, because it's a pain to measure using platinum NMR. The signal to noise ratio at 10 millik is very poor. We have to really struggle with this. Let me tell you another interesting incident. When we started building the 2006 nuclear refrigerator, we asked for a separate ground. Of course, Kurup went and hit the ceiling. You are asking for a separate ground in this institute? Anyway, then finally I explained to Kurup that, you know, our good friends have very nice lasers doing fantastic things. When they switch off, I get the kick. So then Kurup understood, and then we started having a separate ground in 2007 for this experiment. But I think slowly now few more have been added to this ground, I think. So my only request to the electrical section is that please don't ask the laser guys ground to this. So I hope they have faithfully followed that. But we see a continuous degradation of the north from the 2000 to 2010. I can attribute to that, because I did trace initially there were about 5 or 6 other low power lines also were connected. But now I think it must be 20 or 30. I mean, it's impossible to have one ground for one experiment. So I can understand. So I think there's another way to measure this temperature, is to do what is known as a Coringa relation. Coringa relation is that you have this spin lattice relaxation time, nuclear spin lattice relaxation time. It is related to a constant K divided by T. This is known as a Coringa constant, which is specific for the nuclear. For platinum, it is 30 milliseconds. So if you can measure, the tau 1, that is what you do. You apply again a magnetic field along the Z direction, collapse this spin by applying a field along the Y direction, and remove this field, it will try to go back along the Z direction with this expression. So if you can follow this spin lattice relaxation time magnetization as a function of time, you can pick up this tau 1. And once you know tau 1, you know what is K, and you can easily read the temperature. So we cross check the Curie-Weiss relation of the nuclear spins with respect to the nuclear spin relaxation time. Important thing here is that the nuclear spin among themselves have a very short relaxation time. They come to equilibrium much faster than the spin lattice relaxation time. So we built the NMR. So this is the ranges from 10 milli K to 39 micro Kelvin. There were about 4,000 insulated platinum wires of 20 micron. Again, we need individual wires because the eddy current effects are large. So it is mounted in a copper foil, and we have a small magnetic field. Typically, you must have heard about megahertz NMR and gigahertz NMR. Here, we don't do that. We cannot do that. Our fields are of the order of 200 gauss. So we work at 195 kilohertz NMR. That's good enough to measure temperatures. So we did one run. That was the November of 2010. You see this free, as I told you, M is equal to M naught 1 minus E by tau. That is this. So this thermometer can tell you what the relaxation time is. So we couldn't go below 55 micro Kelvin. The reason why we couldn't go below micro is because our power supply cannot ramp the current very slowly, because the relaxation time of this is of the order of several hours. So power supply has to ramp the current, because we want to do an adiabatic demagnetization. So the power supply has to ramp the current much lower than the temperature becomes stable. So what happened here was that the power supplies which we had, it was giving 1 milliamp per second. This is good enough for normal measurements. 1 milliamp per second is, something like 60 milliamp per minute. So you can, normal magnets, you have to go up to 90 amps to get 9 Tesla field. So normal things, it is good enough. But it was not good enough for us. So we again interacted with the suppliers. So just tell them that we want to do this. And then they asked why. So we said we have a problem. So they said, is it 10 pieces or 100 pieces which you want to buy? I said we want to buy one. Then I told them that this, see, there are other universities are coming in. They will ask this thing from you. So then they decided that same cost for the power supply, they sent it to us. $5,000, I think. So before that, I think it's important, what is the cooling power? The cooling power is defined as the amount of heat leak it can withstand without increasing the temperature. So we have about cooling power of 5 nanowatt at 100 microkelvin. It is, believe me, it is very huge. Okay, so that is because we have 5 kilograms of copper, which we cool to 40 microkelvin. And the typical heat leak, because of a heat switch is so good, it's about 50 picowatt. Okay, so we got the better power supply. Now they gave us 30 microamp per second. So you have to wait ages to do the DMAC. In fact, typically we take 3 days to do the DMAC decision. Initially we do very fast, and then from level of something like 10 amp, we go very, very slow. And so you can see that, you know, the temperature versus B by T is really linear. That's what it should be. And of course, because of the heat leak and so on, we stop at 9 millitesla. The important thing is that we can hold it for 36 hours at 40 microkelvin. Because these measurements, typically at 100 microkelvin, each measurement takes about 3 to 4 hours. So you will have 4 or 5 data points only in a day. You have to wait that much for the equilibrium to come. Okay, so this is to tell you how tough is to measure the temperature. So what do? The mixing chamber, you have a thermal switch, you cut off this, do a demagnetization, the nuclear spin cools to 50 microkelvin. Via the hyperfine interaction, it cools the electrons. The electrons via electron-phonon interaction cools the lattice. So how do you measure the temperature? This is copper. Now, how do you measure the temperature? This is platinum. This lattice which is cool, it cools the platinum lattice. Through electron-phonon interaction, it cools the platinum electrons. Through hyperfine interaction, it cools the platinum nuclear spins. And that's what you measure. So believe me, it works. Only thing is that you have to wait. You know, so you have to wait such for a longer time for each measurement. The moment you go below 1 millik, you have no hope but to wait for the thermal equilibrium to happen. And so the sample is connected there, to which will also feel cool. So this is what the Murphy's law, which will work very well here. So, you know, initially you cool with liquid nitrogen, then you go to remove the liquid nitrogen the next day, transfer helium, you have a calibration, you do a calibration. This is cerium magnesium nitrate, which I think Anil Kumar will talk. I talked to you about the noise sensor. You calibrate the noise sensor at 4.2K because that's a good fixed point. It's a boiling point of helium. Then you pump the helium 4. This is what Anil does in 1K pot, takes it down to 1.4K, I think 2K. Then you condense this helium 3, helium 4. Then you pump over the, pumping over the helium 3, circulate the mixture. Then you reach 7 millikelvin. Then you switch and apply a magnetic field. So it goes to 70 millik. You have to remove this heat. Typically takes about 48 hours. Then you start the calibration of platinum NMR with the noise sensor. Then the switch is open. Then 48 hours, if everything goes well, you reach 40 microkelvin. Now, when I told this to my student Om, he said, "Wow!" So then I told him, "Now you have to build a magnetometer to measure." So he looked and up and down. He said, "Let me think for 2 days." So he came back. I must say, I am grateful to him. He came back. He said, "Let me. I will build it." So what I'm going to tell you is that. So see, our aim is to find superconductivity in bismuth. We knew that such a superconductor will have very small critical field. Critical field is the field in which the superconductor becomes normal. So we knew that the Earth's field, which is 40 microtesla, is huge. So if you need to shield it from the earth's field before you make a magnetometer. So what he did was, we have cryoperm which has a very high permeability material, and initially shield that, and then superconductor is also a very nice shielding material because it cannot have a magnetic field inside, it just expels all the magnetic field. So you have a combination of cryoperm and the superconductor to achieve a field of something like 1 nanotesla. How do you measure this 1 nanotesla? So you have to use, this is a commercial instrument, it's called a flux gauge magnetometer from a company called Bartington, which has a resolution of 0.1 nanotesla. So what do you do? You check this at, you can't check it at very low temperature to start with, you check it at 4K, do a calibration, magnet current as a function of field. So what we have is the two coils, primary coil and the secondary coil. Primary is the one we apply a small magnetic field, and secondary is where we pick up the magnetization from the sample. So of course, some details about this cryoperm. This is a commercial company, this is from the German company which supplies this, and you can see this permeability as you go towards a lower temperature. We did the magnetization, that is mu, down to 50 millikelvin. It is at least, it doesn't go down, it just saturates here. So it has a mu of something like 60,000. So the field inside, the field outside divided by the field inside is, you know, is proportional to mu. So if the mu is very large, it cuts off. But then this is an ideal system. We have slightly, you know, we have a cylindrical tube, but we have only bottom is closed, the top is not closed that well. So what we see is that in room temperature, when you have this shield to measure, we get only about 1 microtesla or 0.5 microtesla at room temperature, just cryoperm. When you go to a lower temperatures with the superconducting shield, we achieve about 10 nanotesla. Okay, so this is what Ohm built. So he built a magnetometer which is going to this nuclear stage. It has a primary coil and a secondary coil. So the secondary coil, this is the silver rod. Okay, the silver rod, and this is the bismuth sample which I showed here, which is crimped. The silver is annealed so well that it is extremely soft and there is a very thin wall, and then you push this with some silver powder, and this silver is pressed to that to get this thermal contact. And the pickup coil secondary is directly wound on the sample. What you need is 4 turns of niobium wire, which is the secondary, which is going to the what is known as a squid magnetometer, which I will explain to you. So this goes and sits in one of the platform. There are many things which can be mounted. We have an NMR thermometer, noise thermometer, and this magnetometer. So how good is this magnetometer? I don't know whether I have it here. Okay. So before I explain the squid, let me tell you what we did. So we measured superconductivity of lead at higher temperatures, superconductivity of niobium, but you need to measure the superconductivity below 1 millik. So the sample which we took was rhodium, which was done 30 years ago by mentor Frank Pobel, which is at 325 millikelvin, 325 microkelvin. So we use this magnetometer. So what we do in superconductor, I told you, the magnetic field enters in the normal state, it gets expelled. So if you measure the susceptibility, which is the ratio of magnetization by field, you get a jump because it becomes a perfect diamagnet. So this is what we use to measure superconductivity. Because this is a bulk phenomenon, unless you have the whole thing is expelling, you can't, you know, you can say that what fraction of it is superconducting or not by looking at this. So we see that for the platinum, and we also made the temperature dependence, showed that our magnetometer works at low temperatures. So let me just briefly tell you what this squid is all about. So I think we have such squid magnetometers in our institute. They are commercial ones, costing 2.1, 2.2 crores, something like that. And it works from 1-2 Kelvin to 300 Kelvin with the magnetic field. So what we decided was to build a magnetometer, not of that kind, but works at below 10 millikelvin. So this is superconduct, SQUID is an acronym for the superconducting ring, superconducting quantum interference device, which is essentially a superconducting wire or ring, which is shunted by a Josephson junction. Josephson junction, low temperature physics, I think Anil will talk, I will make him talk. So then you have two kinds of SQUID, one is a RF SQUID, where this coupling to the SQUID is done by a RF circuit, or you can also do a DC SQUID where the biasing is done by a DC voltage. So this is now a dying breed, I think, because the sensitivity of this and the ease of operation, thin film SQUIDs and so on, becomes much more easier. So the RF SQUIDs have slowly going out of the market. So what we see is this DC SQUID. How does it work? So this is a, both RF SQUID and DC SQUID works like a, you think of it as a transducer. What do you do? Apply a magnetic field, so that is in the form of flux, and that voltage output is a periodic oscillation of this flux. This can be rigorously shown, I am not going to show that. So what you, so for your practical purpose, you think as a transducer. You give a flux, it gives you an alternative voltage output. So to compare how sensitive it is, let's assume 50 microtesla earth field. This is where phi naught is the flux quantum, which is given by this, and it is about 10 to the power of 4 phi naught. Noise level of the state of the art DC SQUID is 10 to the power of 6 phi naught per square root of hertz. So it can in principle have a resolution of this. So it has a fantastic resolution. The only thing is that you can't directly use it. See, the problem is a little bit on the electronics. So this is your voltage as a function of phi. So a small change in phi causes only a small change in delta V. That is, you know, it's about 10 to 50 microvolt. The transfer function, transfer coefficient is small. And so in this form, it is a bit difficult to use. So what we do is what is known as this flux lock loop. So which I will tell you, which essentially linearizes this voltage. So as a function of phi, you will have a linear voltage happening. That we do by doing, initially people were doing, you know, have an RF resistor and then just null this, whatever the applied flux which is coming in, by a modulated coil. And the only problem is that the noise of the bipolar, this preamp which is here, and the other electronic noise actually limits this operation in this form. So what Clark did was, to do a modulation by a 100 kilohertz frequency. So this modulation, we can do a phase lock loop and then do an integration, and you can get the large large reduction in the noise, and you can measure. The commercial SQUIDs have what is known as, this is what is known as the flux lock loop, because you null the effect of the flux which is entering to this by this modulation. And earlier you saw this triangular waveform. What we see after this linearization, you see a voltage as a linear function of the magnetic field which is going through this. So all the commercial SQUIDs have this, So when we build this fridge, then we decided to look at what has been happening in this low temperature. Some nuclear facilities have gone out of the way. I think the one which is built by Mentor, Frank Pobel, I think once he retired, this moved out. So the ones which are prominent ones are the Helsinki, which is low temperature, Lancaster, Cornell, Florida. So in terms of cooling power and the ultimate temperature, we somewhere just behind the Helsinki and Lancaster. We are third in the rank. Okay, so now we have developed a squid magnetometer, which is capable of measuring magnetization, and also you have an ultra low temperature platform. So you have a platform from 40 microkelvin to 300 K. So you can study phase transition in nearly 7 orders of magnitude and temperature. So what do? First you want to look at this periodic table. This is the periodic table of superconducting elements. So here you see many of them are superconducting. The green ones are superconducting at ambient pressure and also at higher pressures. The red ones superconducts only under pressure or in thin film forms, or is it sandwiched between two different metals. And so there are notable gaps. One is magnesium. The important thing is that many of these superconducting elements can be explained, at least an order of magnitude temperature, transition temperature, explained by this BCS theory. We will come to that. Unfortunately, magnesium fulfills all the characteristics of the BCS theory. You will see that it is supposed to superconduct at 30 millik. We cool down to 100 microkelvin. It's still not superconducting. There's a big question mark there. Then our aim was always on bismuth. Why bismuth? Bismuth and ambient pressure, it has a low carrier system. The carrier concentration is only 10 to the power of 17. Normal metals, it is 10 to the power of 22 electrons per centimeter cube. So it's 5 orders of magnitude small in carrier concentration. The other important thing is that there are two relevant energies in this problem. One is electronic energy, which is called the Fermi energy. Other one is the lattice energy. So in bismuth, in all these elements except bismuth, they are comparable. In all other elements, the electronic energy is 3 to 4 orders of magnitude larger than the lattice energy. We will come to that why it is important. So that is why bismuth is peculiar. Nobody expected that it is a superconductor. People gave up after up to 10 millik. People measured in 20 years ago, they just gave up. So now, comparable. So lattice energy is about 15 milli electron volt. The electronic energy, the Fermi energy, is only a 25 milli electron volt. So typically in metals, let's say tin, it is in electron volts at the EF, whereas milli electron volts for the lattice energy. So to continue that, see, why is it important? Because the BCS theory tells you that what is relevant is that small h cross omega d across the Fermi surface. So because you have, so it becomes a three-dimensional problem, becomes a sheet of h cross omega d, a two-dimensional problem. So as you know that, you know, if you have a 1D and 2D case, however shallow is the potential, well, there is a bound state. Whereas 3D, you need a depth to get this. So that is the reason why the electronic energy, the Fermi energy, the Mitchell theorem comes into the picture, that you will always have a bound state when EF is greater than omega d. So yeah, so the point here is that, as I said, if you find anything on the, add anything on the periodic table, it gets noticed. So the superconductor in iridium and tungsten, beryllium, rhodium, which I briefly explained to you, lithium, we still don't understand why it's happening at such a low temperature. So it took 16 years for the superconductivity of rhodium, 24 years for the lithium, and now 9 years for bismuth.
This year counting is from the date you start your experiment to the date you achieve, is it?
Which one? No, the date where it's published. Good question. Okay, so just a few slides on for the students. So how do we picturize this attractive interaction between the electrons? One simple way is to consider electrons as a, you know, assembly of positive ions and the electrons moving around. Assume this electron which is going through, it creates a net positive charge here because the positive ions gets attracted to this. The other electron which is coming here sees this positive charge, gets attracted. So this is a simpler way to look at electron attraction, because you need some binding to get this superconductivity. So naively, it says that the electron velocity is much larger than the ionic velocity, because if this has the same velocity as electron is not going to see this positive charge, right? You won't have a binding. So it's a simply crude way of looking at this BCS problem, attraction problem. So there are many assumptions went into the BCS theory. So the BCS theory's final goal is not to calculate the transition temperature. The final goal is to show how beautifully the attraction interaction between two electrons come about, and that's how they got the Nobel Prize. So the bonus is that they were able to explain an order of magnitude transition temperature. See, the expression is this. This is the only equation I am going to tell you. This is the theta d dead by temperature. This is the density of states at the Fermi level. That is the number of available states per unit volume at a given energy. V is this electron-electron interaction. And this is the expression which is given. And of course, the electrons have Coulomb interaction. This Coulomb repulsion is modified by the presence of large number of electrons. We are talking about 10 to the power of 22 electrons in the system. So you have a screen Coulomb interaction, which is generally given by this 0.1 to 0.13. So we use that as a simple thing to calculate. See, we know lambda, which is this. We know theta d, that is a dead by temperature which you can measure from the heat capacity. And if you calculate, you see sodium of course is 1 nanokelvin, nobody is interested. Aluminium is 2.5 kelvin, but actual temperature is 1.2. Not bad for a theory which made very large assumptions, because you don't expect that it will be at the same. What you can expect, reasonably ask, is this the same order of magnitude? So which works even for lead. Magnesium is a puzzle. It is supposed to be 30 millik. We cool down to 100 microkelvin, it's not. And this is 0.2 nanokelvin. So nobody would like to even attempt this. And we see that it is 0.5 millikelvin. I will show you what. So this is the same experiment, similar experiment like we did it for the rhodium. So you measure the susceptibility as a function of temperature. You see this sharp fall in the magnetization, just like platinum did. Only thing is that you can also vary the field from 0.4 micro tesla to 3.7 micro tesla. You can see that it is, the TC is, as you increase the magnetic field, the TC will decrease. So you follow this curve basically. So as you can see that it is only 5.2 micro tesla. The Earth's field is about 40 micro tesla. So if you are not shielded, you are not going to see this. But there are interesting things here, that the zero field cool, you cool the system, apply follow this warm up, you get this curve. When you apply a field and then follow, you see this, what do you call, zero field cool and field cool are the same. So there is very little pinning in the system. If you have magnetic flux gets pinned, as in the case of type 2 superconductors or in this one, you would see this field cool will go somewhere here. The other thing which is important here is that it seems to follow a simple parabolic law. Most important is that you take ratio, that is the upper critical field by TC, it's 3.9.4 milli tesla per Kelvin. For a moment you see that, let's assume BCS works. What is the number from the BCS? It's about 0.8. So there is an order of magnitude change here. So clearly we need to go beyond the BCS. So a nice perspective was given by Kamran Benia. He is a world renowned expert on bismuth, has published about 10, 12 science and several natures on this. So he gave a perspective on what is important, why bismuth is, superconductivity is important. So this is the energy scales of superconductors and superfluidity. Of course, astrophysics guys are far ahead of us. Condensed matter, you have all kinds of superfluids and proton superconductivity in pulses. So forget that for a moment. what we look at is, you see bismuth is somewhere here with a carrier concentration, the lowest carrier concentration. Its cousin is SRTiO3, which is also where the Fermi energy is even much smaller than the lattice energy. So I must pause here and tell you that we were confident of seeing bismuth superconductivity because of this, because when we entered the field, this was there 50 years before and it was still going on. This is oxygen deficient strontium titanate. Strontium titanate is an insulator. So you take away some oxygen, it becomes a superconductor with a small carrier concentration. So we knew that there is a cousin of bismuth which is also low carrier concentration exists. So that is the reason why we went there. So you see that there are two systems which are somewhat similar, not exactly the same, showing superconductivity even with low carrier concentration. But there is a quantum of jump here, there is a, you know, two orders of magnitude jump between these two. So what we hope is that if the theory is known for the superconductivity of bismuth, there is no harm in expecting another quantum jump of two orders of magnitude somewhere here for the low carrier systems. So this is what I think we are waiting for the superconductivity theory to tell us why it is superconducting. The conventional BCS theory is not possible. We need to look at some new mechanism to give us this superconductivity. Of course, there is interesting new mechanism here, but these are can be explained by the extension of electron phonon coupling constant, electron phonon theory, and of course there is the new guy in the market, pressurized hydrogen sulfide. So now let's come back to bismuth. So often the superconductivity is understood, or some clues you get by studying its normal state properties. The simplest normal state properties people study is electrical resistivity, but it's not so simple in bismuth because it is very difficult to measure below 50 millikelvin. I'll come to this point. So there is a theory by Gayamarki. So this is the log R versus T for bismuth. So it has a linear temperature at high temperatures from 25 Kelvin to 300 K. Then it becomes a T square dependence at low temperatures. Then, you know, something like 3 to 4 Kelvin, it goes T to the power of 5. So this T to the power of 5, it's not simply electron phonon interaction. Now people have realized that there is something is happening. They were suggesting the possibility of plasmons in bismuth. But then the region one has to investigate is this. Nobody has done any measurements below 50 millikelvin. So what we want is that from 0.5 millikelvin to 50 millikelvin, two orders of magnitude in temperature range, we need to measure the resistance, because that would give some clue about what is the mechanism of superconductivity in bismuth. Where are we? Okay. I think before, yeah, so I come to my end of my talk. So what I am saying is that there is still physics at the lowest temperature region which can be explored. I mean, imagine at 100 years ago when Kamerling onus has not cooled the system to 4K, you wouldn't have observed superconductivity. So it is not advisable to make a statement that there is no physics can be done, everything is done below 1 millikelvin. I think there is a lot of things have been done. Not only this, there are new heavy fermion systems which superconducts below 2 millikelvin. So there is a lot of rush to Frassati now to make nuclear magnetometers, nuclear refrigerators. So this temperature region is coming back again with the vengeance. So wait, where am I? So it squares and it shows an unconventional superconductivity. It has to go beyond the standard model. So to understand the low carrier, we need to measure transport measurement at least down to 0.1 millikelvin, 100 microkelvin, never been done. So what we had to do is to do either measure, see the point is that the resistance of bismuth even at 1K is 1 microohm. So we can't send very large currents. If you send 1 milliamp, it heats up everywhere. even 1 milliamp means it is 1 nanovolt. See, most of your Keithley instruments which you has a resolution only 1 nanovolt. So, we need to do something better. So, we need to do something much better, because you are going to send 10 microamp, you want to measure 1 microohm. So, you are already in picovolt region. So, what we need is use a squid as a null amplifier to pick this picovolt meter probe. Or as I told you, Johnson's noise. See, the Johnson's noise thermometer works down to now down to 50 microkelvin. So, instead of measuring the noise, you connect the resistor and measure the noise at fixed temperature, then you can measure the resistance. So, the only thing is that you have a fluctuating resistor. Now, the resistance will have a temperature dependence. So, the noise voltage will have a temperature dependence, but that is not a problem. I mean, if you can do that. So, what we plan to do is the joint thing which we are talking with the Magnion, who made the noise sensor, to supply us the basic chip where we could connect our own resistor to measure this. This is still going on, because they need a stage to measure microkelvin. We can happily provide that. So, this is the most important crucial question, that if the mechanism is known, can we see superconductivity of bismuth at higher temperature, some materials like strontium titanate or even better to see for a different system. Then what are these other two? So, look at the periodic table. There are two other semi-metals like bismuth, antimony and arsenic. Can we see superconductivity in them? I think this is it's a question which we need to, which may or may not succeed. So, we don't know. So, I think I will leave it here and expect your questions. Thank you very much for your patience. I am sorry if I have lifted out a little bit from my colloquium, but that was necessary. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, yeah.
I can achieve higher temperature.
No, if you increase the field, it gets killed. See, if you increase beyond the HC naught, beyond 5 micro Tesla, the super, it is no longer a superconductor. So, it is a normal. So, for a lowest field, you get the highest transition temperature. As you increase the field, the transition temperature decreases and it becomes normal. Yeah, it's actually Anil will talk about that. So we have the laser guys have these nice platforms. So we borrow that from them. So we can cut on frequencies down to 5 hertz. Not only that, the RF noise and the magnetic noise is another problem. So, you know, world over they build the room with shielding. You know, so but you know we can't do that. So we shield the cryostat. So, what we found was simple mild steel works well. Only it has to be some 3 or 4 millimeter thick. We cover it watertight and that seems to work. So, anyway, Anil will talk about this, how we get down to the chip noise things.
Any other questions?
So, the one slide before summary,
yeah,
we had this temperature dependence.
Sorry.
Last one.
Yeah, sorry, wait. Yeah.
No, after this.
This one or this one?
Just one last summary slide before that. This one.
Ah.
So this temperature dependence, is it out of that theory?
Which one?
Yeah.
Yeah. So theory stops here. So they expect that it should go down like this.
No, what I am saying that is T to the power 1, T to the power 2 and T to the power 5.
Yeah.
And with those Becks.
Right. You know, see,
or they assume something, you know, different.
Yeah, see, the point is that the spectrum itself is changing. So, what we do here is the normal lattice takes over, phonons takes over. Here, what is known as a Fermi liquid comes into the picture.
No, that is part of, included in the theory, that's all.
Yeah, yeah, that's all included.
Yeah.
And what they are saying is that there is plasmons here.
Okay.
And these plasmons in bismuth can have energies smaller than the Fermi energy. So what the phonons does to the standard superconductors, these plasmons could do to bismuth. So that's what Giamarchi believes. There are three guys who believe this. Giamarchi, Gorkov, Marvin Cohen believes now they have coming out with the models with plasmon. Then there are two guys in India, Lad, who is already published, already in the CONMAT. He talks about fluctuating excitons. See, you have electrons and holes in bismuth. It's a compensated metal. So the possibility of excitons there cannot be ruled out. So Bhaskaran thinks that there is an exciton condensation here. And of course, his model has not come out. The other guys have put up this. So there are theoreticians already have two different avenues to look for the why it is superconducting. But we still, the jury is not out.
Okay, no more questions. Once again,
thanks. So one way is to
lecture.
Get this is to get your student to give a colloquium, ask him to go somewhere else, and you give the colloquium. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Thank you.
I just want to run one more question. This Johnson noise that you're mentioning, because it goes like the voltage squared goes
down. Right.
Now, how far can you use that method?
They have gone down to 50 microkelvin. So yeah, we have done it up.
How much can you push that down? I mean, is there any physical?
No, it's a question of electronics and detection.
Achha.
So it can measure down to even
principle,
even 1 microkelvin. Yeah, 1 microkelvin.